This is an NITV radio podcast. For the full program, visit sbs.com.au/NITV radio.
The book is a reprint of my PhD. It took me five or seven years of pretty intense research. What I've been able to do is to validate my hypothesis. My hypothesis is that there was a nexus between ambiguous race-based judicial determinations and community xenophobia. In layman's language, I'm saying that judges who make decisions based on race, which are specifically Aboriginal people who come before them in courts of law, are unduly influenced by society in which they were raised. I'll use the example of a young boy or a young girl, let's say for argument's sake a young boy. In rural Queensland, for instance, most of the people who end up in the legal profession are from middle to upper class families, and in the main they don't really have much contact with Aboriginal people, even within the communities in which they live. They go off to boarding school. Very few Aboriginal people in the boarding schools to socialise and to learn from. But the whole argument of my hypothesis is that these the normalisation of racism or racist thought, whereby a young kid at, say, 3 or 4, sitting around a barbecue, maybe a birthday celebration or Easter or Christmas, they get their uncles and auntie come over, have a few drinks, and all of a sudden they're a little inebriated and they start sharing racist jokes. Everyone laughs and no one complains, so the kids automatically think that it's okay to tell racist jokes. They go to school. Years later, white kids in the playground are telling racist jokes. They go off to university later on, or boarding school, and then off to universities. Still very few Aboriginals in their law classes. They're telling racist jokes, even maybe even sharing it in with their conservative white lecturer at university. They're all laughing at it. So this kid, all of a sudden, growing up in rural Queensland or even in suburbia Brisbane, hearing people laugh at racist jokes. So in effect, they're condoning that practice. When it comes time for them to join a law firm and for them to rise to the level of being a partner in a law firm, they almost have to emulate that of the existing partners, act and behave and think in a very conservative way towards all things white, and that is society in general, it's a white society. So they make the partner of a law firm or a principal player in a law firm, and then in order to become a magistrate, the government's endorsed magistrate from law firms, and you must really be thinking and acting like judges in the existing structure. And they're very ultra-conservative, white, aging white men or women. So by the time they graduate from a law firm to a magistrate, and then all of a sudden they're faced with their first Aboriginal person before them in a court of law, it's been grounded into them that it's okay to tell racist jokes, it's okay to look at Aboriginal people as being infringers of societal codes of conduct. And so if they wish to impose a custodial sentence for a minor indiscretion or breach of law, they know that the white population are not going to kick up a stink saying that's an unfair sentence, even if it's bordering on being outside the laws of precedence. So that's basically been my argument, and I've been able to validate that by comparing and contrasting sentences over the years, right back from 1838 with the Myall Creek Massacre right through to the present, whereby I looked at what white people are charged with the same offence get compared to Aboriginal people. So yeah, so it's been a long journey, and I'm probably explaining more about the acquisition of racist thought, the normalisation of whiteness in effect, right through to how a magistrate or a judge is no different from any other person holding a position in white Australia today.
If we're looking at things like issues around deaths in custody on mandatory sentencing, things like people being sentenced for fines, non-payment of fines, is that included in what you're talking about with this publication?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, whilst I don't identify every single case around, I give plenty of examples of the high rates of Aboriginal incarceration. I look at their education compared to white Australia. I look at their families' contact with the criminal justice system, all those sort of things. And basically, I'm really saying that Australia is basically a very intolerant country in terms of how they view others, others being non-white people. And Aboriginal people, in particular, have been singled out for special treatment. That's why we're overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And that is the diaspora. When the British came and settled in Australia, up until 1992, when the Mabo case debunked the myth of terra nullius, it was assumed that Australia was an empty land, unoccupied. Now, for that position to change, for instance, white people have never ever questioned that they own Australia. They honestly believe that they came here, it was empty, and they settled and they developed and they created a modernity. They created a modern Australia. So for them to say they are original Australians in terms of a white Australia, they need to debunk any myth that Aboriginal people received first. That's why if you look at the early 40s and 50s and 60s, Aboriginal people in the main were living in fringe camps on the outskirts of most rural towns, which is out of sight, out of mind. Whilst Australia assumed the mantle of being the founders and the creators of this big, vast land, the alternative to that would be a diaspora, that Australia is a bunch of British people who settled here and they're really just all British people and they form together. It's like a diaspora of the Middle Eastern people or Sudanese people. So to get away from that notion that that is somebody else's land, they introduced the myth of terra nullius. Now, I know it's sounding very academic, but in order to for me to explain this in very simple terms, layman terms, I've had to go back and explain the contact period right through to the present. So it's without any doubt that it was the accumulation of racist thought or whiteness, which I use a whiteness theory, to explain today's predicament. And today's predicament had been predicated by years and years of people denying Aboriginal people the rightful ownership or the sovereignty of this country. And so they're there for they can do and they can do whatever they want to Black Australia. But in saying that, it also comes back to judicial sentencing. They can do and treat Aboriginal people any way they want. And the more they view Aboriginal people as infringers of societal codes of conduct, the less likely it is that they will believe that they were the original owners of this country as well.
You're with NITV Radio.
From my knowledge, like I know that the Australian Law Reform Commission has been looking at the disparity and the high proportion rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in custody, and they're definitely looking at the issues around sentencing and fine options. So we're sort of stuck in a bit of a situation at the moment where if people are dying in custody, no one's actually been, there's been no charges laid. You know, we've also got this recent case where with the young boy from Kalgoorlie who ended up being run over, and there's, you know, there's been a lower level of sentencing on that case. So how can this entrenchment of what is seen to be racism within the judicial system, how can changes be made?
Well, I'm recommending that white Australia, particularly the judiciary, the judicial membership takes ownership of the current predicament with Aboriginal people being in custody. They also take ownership of the fact that they are inherently racist, because if you don't admit that you've got a problem in relation to race, you will always be in denial and you will continue to go on your merry way of just handing out custodial sentences left, right and centre, you know, without any fear of being challenged by the broader community, because the broader community supports anything the judiciary does. I mean, they're supposed to be the exemplars for white society. So unless the judges can sit down and say, oh yeah, this fellow's made a very valid point, I will reassess my position in light of what he's saying. I'll give you an example. One of the cases was, there was an Aboriginal man in the Northern Territory some years ago. He was charged with indecent exposure on a community. Now the judge, in writing his briefing notes for his sentence, he read, and then the Abbo then did an the Aboriginal then, so he only apologised when he read in his notes because the media were in the room. Now, even the judges are writing freehand Abbos and stuff like that. They're not even being sensitive about how it looks or how it reads. It's just what comes into their head. And so it's really, really crazy. And another case I did, which really shocked me, was there was a white man in once again in Darwin, who 23 years of age, was high on methamphetamines. His sister actually reported him as being high on drugs, and he ran over an Aboriginal youth. I think he was a little kid. He's only about 11 or 12, I think. He's riding his BMX bike in suburbia Darwin, and ran over him and killed him. Now, the judge gave him home detention, no period of incarceration, even though his sister said he's high on drugs and all that sort of stuff. When the legal service appealed this case, the judge, the director of public prosecution said, oh, no, we're quite happy with the sentence from the judge. And the judge said that they took into consideration his age, which was 23, which isn't really young at all, but that he was 23 and he had a good chance of rehabilitation, therefore he didn't need to be incarcerated. Now, I pose the same question in my book, and that is, what if an Aboriginal man, 23 years of age, high on methamphetamines and alcohol, ran over a white boy, 11 or 12-year-old, riding his BMX bike in suburbia Darwin? Would he be given home detention? Now, you've got to ask yourself the question. Do you think he would be given home detention? What do you reckon?
I reckon he'd be given a lot more than that.
Absolutely. And there are many, many cases. Another case I'll give you is there was an auxiliary police officer, a warden, at a jail in Darwin. And once again, Darwin, I don't know what Darwin, but there's a lot of cases around Australia, but I'm just using this one. These ones jumped out at me. And this warden, at night, there were three Aboriginal women locked up in a cell. Now, they were long grasses. Do you know what a long grass is?
Yeah.
Someone who's homeless and lives in a long grass in the fringe of Darwin. They were locked up. This man went with his keys, unlocked the cell, walked them, because he knew where the cameras were, walked them into the stairwell of the prison and had them perform oral sex on him. One of them wouldn't do it, but the others two were forced into doing it. And they complained. He went to court. A lot of good references from a lot of good white people in Darwin saying he's a fine man who's got good respect for women. So the judge and the jury dismissed the claim made by the women, saying that they were unreliable, and he got off without a charge. Once again, I ask the question, what if it was an Aboriginal warden on duty that night, and the three white women were from, say, a trailer park, you know, or a public housing commission, and he took three white women into the staircase or stairwell and asked them to perform oral sex on him, and the women all complained. Do you think the Aboriginal police officer, the white woman, would not be believed if it was a black man doing it to them? What do you reckon?
No, he'd probably get done for sexual assault.
There you are. So once again, there's myriads of those examples in my PhD, as long with all the other, the chronology of events throughout the years of the type of way white Australia views Aboriginal people and the cases of the judiciary. So... yeah, that's basically what my book is about.
Dr. Hagan, have you received any responses from magistrates who've actually read your book?
Well, the book only just came out in the last couple of days.
Right.
It's going very, very well on sales online. So people can buy my book by going to www.firstnationstelegraph.com. Nations is with an S. Firstnations.com. I'll just type in Stephen Hagan and it'll take it to my website. I've spoken at some forums prior to my book coming out, and I've actually had two federal court judges come to me at one conference I spoke at. I didn't know there were judges. One of them actually said, this morning I came from a courthouse, and he said, what you described in your paper, which is basically saying what I'm saying to you now, he said, is absolutely correct. He said, I come every day. He said, judges sit around having a cup of tea telling racist jokes. I've also had conversation with Aboriginal. There's about 10 or 11 Aboriginal magistrates and a judge in Australia. And I spoke to two magistrates in particular and from Queensland, and they told me that whilst they won't come out in public and make comment on my book, they've supported 100% because it's true. From their words, they know exactly what I'm talking about, and they said, I'm glad you're talking about the elephant in the room.
Well, Dr. Hagan, thank you so much for talking to NITV Radio today. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
This was an NITV Radio podcast. For more, visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio or download the SBS Radio app.